This is the Personality Psychology Podcast, and I am René Mattus. And today I want to talk about personality assessment, and I want to talk about how personality assessments can be used in the real life. And I'm very excited to be joined by two really heavyweights on these questions, William Bill Revell and Robert Bob Hogan. Let's start with you giving brief introductions about you, and then we'll take it from there. Bill.
I am a personality psychologist at Northwestern University and have been here for 50 years now. I'm a personality psychologist because to me, personality is the last refuge of the generalist. I can do whatever I want. I can say, oh, I do personality. So I can do mathematics, which I do a lot, or I can do scale construction, or I can do theory about motivation, and all of that's personality. And as long as I teach my courses, my colleagues are happy with me. And so I love personality as a field because it's whatever you want to make it. Been a great admirer of Bob Hogan since I met him many years ago at Johns Hopkins. And he is the inspiration for personality assessment.
I have to say, Bill, that your quote, personality's last refuge of the generalist, is on the website of our podcast. So it's really central to this whole thing here. Bob.
My background was in physics and engineering, but I decided to do a PhD in psychology for reasons that don't matter. I did my PhD at Berkeley, where I worked at the Institute for Personality Assessment Research, which is a direct line of descent from the German military assessment centers of World War II to the Harvard Psychological Clinic to OSS in World War II to there. I do not like academic psychology. I think it's going nowhere. I loved what was going on at this Personality Research Institute because real problems, real people, the kinds of things that actually matter. And in a way, generating really impressive results that most people have already forgotten. The best research that's ever been done on the psychology of creativity, for example. And strongly empirical with a lot of the ideas behind it and practice solving practical problems. I'm a recovering academic. I spent 41 years in the university and I regret every minute of it.
And what are you doing now, Bob?
Do what I like, which is research and write. I can do that in a free way because I sort of ignore academic publications these days. Just nothing but orthodoxy and political correctness.
So we probably should mention that you also have studied one of the largest companies, global companies, that actually puts the personality assessments in practical use, right?
We've done research on. We have data. We have data for performance in every job in the world economy.
And for Bill as well, I think.
Example of how personality actually works. I mean, I cite Bob a lot as demonstrations of personality actually predicts real things.
In a practical sense, at least in the U.S. and not maybe not in Europe, personality predicts occupational performance, and it's completely colorblind, genderblind, race-blind. It's perfectly blind. In the history of music, women used to not be allowed to play in symphony orchestras until they began doing blind rehearsals or blind interviews where they'd be behind the screen and play, and then women could get a selected based on personality is the same as that blind interview. It allows talented people to shine through without being discriminated against. It's the right answer to the problem that IQ was supposed to solve.
We're already sort of going into my first real question is, what do you think have been the biggest sort of developments, improvements in the field of personality science over the last 4 or 5 decades?
Well, I would say two things. First, the onslaught, the storm that was precipitated by Walter Mischel. The nihilistic storm precipitated, well, absolutely killed personality psychology. It just went away. And that problem was the lack of interest in theory, I think. But what that did, the what brought personality psychology back. So this is the first big development. Walter Mischel was a catastrophe. It was a long, fallow period. And then the development of the five-factor model came along. That led to an interest in trait theory. So what you have today, the biggest development in the last X years is the rise of trait theory as a paradigm for personality research. The second big development was the five-factor model. It provided a taxonomy of personality that non-psychologists could understand. It was taken up immediately by in the late 1970s, early 1980s by IO Psychology Division 14. And it just took off like a rocket. So there's more personality research going on in Division 14 now than there is in Division 8.
I agree with that history. I mean, I started graduate school the year Michelle's book came out, but I came to graduate school having read Hanns Eysenck, and where theory was really important. And I spent probably the first 30 years of my career trying to test various theories, both Eysenckian theory, and also I spent some time with Jack Atkinson's models of motivation. And both of these were very nice theoretical systems, that were hard to explain. The big five is, or big few, as I like to call it. This is a term that you use, Renee, that I've taken to use your term. The big few is understandable to other people, and that's part of it. But the problem is, I think personality threw away the important part of the signal. We dropped ability, and we dropped interests. And those actually, in addition to the big few, allow us to understand and predict things. I mean, I am familiar with the work at IPR that Bob worked. And that creativity work was brilliant, but we somehow lost the ability to study interests. And interests are very useful in predicting what you do. Ability also allows you to predict how well you can do things. The big few allows you just to talk about how you tend to choose and work in various occupations. I think we need to be much broader than traditional American personality, which is a big few. I think that was a great mistake. The problem is all of this. The problem of the big five is there's no real theory behind the big five. And Bob has this very nice social ecological blowing the term theory, which is a getting along and getting ahead are really these important goals. And I think that's very important as a theory, but how do you actually use that? And this leads to the whole emphasis I've taken off in the last 5 years, which is just get rid of theory and become an engineer. I mean, I fought this engineering bias. I come from a background of natural scientists. I've decided engineering is what we need to do. Personality is basically human engineering. It's taken me a long time to get to that point, and I credit Bob for pushing this position for many years. But using what actually works. It's not big theory. It's just what works. And to do that, using big data sets allow us to make sure we replicate, which we can do. It's antithetical to everything I've been teaching for the first 45 years of my career, but that's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, go with the data. The data say these big theories don't work. Go with what does work. What works is putting items together, not necessarily for theoretical reasons, but what I call fishing nets. Classical test theory develops really good spears, nice homogeneous scales that are very sharp, very pointed, and not that much use. As you put fishing nets, you catch more fish with fishing nets. The scales are much more diffuse. You can't say what it is. It's these items that predict things. And they work.
Renee, you said there were two parts to your first question. The second was, how has your thinking evolved over time? May I answer that one?
Oh, yeah, of course.
So my thinking, it goes like this. In my view, people are the deadliest invasive species in the history of the earth. People are what are going to kill everything. Wouldn't it make some sense to have some understanding of the nature of human nature? So my view is personality psychology ultimately should be about the nature of human nature. And then that leads to three questions. How and in what important ways are people all alike? How and what in what important ways are people all different? And what's the meaning of particular, how do you account for somebody like Donald Trump? I mean, when you put those first two together, then you have to apply it to something. How can you explain something like Donald Trump? Seems to me the big questions for personality psychology.
So the third question is how to explain particular individuals.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, not general patterns among individuals, but particular individuals. Bill, maybe we could come back to your point a little bit, just to reiterate. I think it might remain a little cryptic for many listeners. What do you mean by this idea that traditional psychometrics creates these beautiful constructs, beautiful scales, beautiful psychometric models, whereas psychometrics that actually matters is something different?
I've spent a lot of time trying to show that psychometrics is overrated. I'm known as a psychometrician. I will confess that. I don't view myself as a psychometrician particularly, but I think most people do. It's not that complicated. It's knowing how to add up items. That's all it is. I mean, factors are merely weighted composites of items. They're item scores that are simply weighted. We've known for since 1930, which I like to say is before my time and before Bob's time, but we've known since about 1930 that adding up things works. And it doesn't matter what the weights are. You have to know what you have to choose the right items. That's all it is. You can get all these factor determinacy issues, and you can get there more statistics you can throw out of a factor analysis or SEM than you. There's as many as there are psychometricians. Each one of us develops our own measure. But it turns out knowing how to add is a really important concept. It turns out and knowing how to cross-validate. Those are the two most important things that came out of scale construction in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. choosing the right items, and then making sure they work in another sample.
I don't think that last 20, 30 years, there is a single psychometrics textbook has published where you haven't written at least one chapter. And so it's quite funny to hear you saying that psychometrics is overrated. Do you think at all, like all these fancy psychometrics we have, all these item response theory parameters, the difficulties and item response curves and the factor loadings and rotations and all the lambdas and taus and omegas and alphas and the CFIs and TLIs, and do they actually have a place in the psychometric that matters in the real-world context? For example, in the practical application that Bob is using.
You have to know how to add. Yeah. But you have to know when an item doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And so not all items are useful for everything. I mean, if you want to predict who's going to get ahead, there are items that actually work. But you don't have to have a great theory of factor indeterminacy or all these wonderful notions. It turns out choosing good items is useful. And as Bob will tell you, businessmen want to know what are the items that help them choose truck drivers. Not all the items are useful for truck drivers, but some are. And it turns out those are fairly straightforward. Put them together, add them up. I don't want to say you shouldn't know psychometrics. It's because it's very important to know what a validity coefficient is. Yes, that's important, but we shouldn't get so taken with our math. Our mathematics is really fun. I enjoy doing psychometrics, right? It's fun, but also just knowing how to add is really important, and subtract too.
Bob, do you agree?
Well, I think what you have in academic psychology, academic personality research, is methods in search of a problem. They've got the cart before the horse. What you need is figure out what's the problem you want to solve, and then find the methods that you need to solve the problem.
In your psychometrics that you do at Hogan Assessment, do you use a lot of these fancy psychometric tools that we love in the field of psychometrics?
I think at Hogan Assessments, we have the largest collection of personality researchers in the world. It's larger than any psychology department I know of. And several of our guys are way more sophisticated about methods than I am. They do stuff that I don't understand all the time. The answer is yes, I guess.
Yeah, I have this feeling too that I like psychometrics in the sense that we have been talking about this sort of psychometrics oriented at all these factor problems and item response problems. It's by many people, it's seen as a sort of little occult science that doesn't necessarily have much real world applications apart from in psychometrics. But your thinking seems to be different. And I think it's quite refreshing. And I think it's a really good thing that we have this thing out in the public that, you know, there are people who actually do psychometrics and that's their life, psychological assessment, but they don't care that much about hardcore, mathematical, beautiful psychometrics because in real applications, it maybe doesn't matter that much.
Problem is, what's the criterion? I mean, Bob says, you know, the important thing is how are people different? How are people the same? What do we want to choose? If we want to choose an occupation, if you want to choose a president, you want to know what the criterion is.
Is there a possibility, if we wanted to get this message across more broadly and people would actually start buying this message and saying, well, psychometrics is all about prediction and we should really care for our ability to predict stuff rather than build beautiful statistical models. How could we achieve that?
I think the problem is conceptual. I think what we've got is a bad definition of personality today, which is all personality is equivalent to trait theory. And that's the five-factor model, and that's deeply impoverished. It seems to me the better definition is we talk about personality in terms of the bright side, the dark side, and the inside. The bright side is what you see in an interview in a first date, and it's what you see with the five-factor model. The dark side is what you see after you marry them, what you see after they come to work. And the inside is values and interests and motives, which are mostly unconscious and which really drive careers. That framework, it gives you a much more kind of interesting way to talk about people and individual differences. And then we have our success map onto that.
Yeah, I mean, and the dark side, Bob brought up Trump. Trump is a classic example of the dark side.
Can we actually explain Trump? I mean, I think we had this discussion about Putin actually with someone when the Ukraine invasion happened. And we had this discussion, like, do we have tools in personality science that can actually help to explain people like Putin?
There are two questions. First question is what constitutes or counts as an explanation? And that's a whole area of discourse by itself about which nobody will agree. And in our view, we can classify them pretty nicely in terms of our 21 or so variables, and we can give you a pretty clear, replicable profile of Trump. And that, for me, counts as an adequate explanation. If you can predict it, you, to some degree, explained it.
You mean predict his behavior?
Yeah, yeah, we can predict him. He's a kind of a caricature. I mean, he's an easy case. He's just a raving narcissist, combination of narcissism and psychopathy with a little bit of paranoia.
explanation is beyond our skills, I think. To say, well, I can describe this person, yes, but to explain him, my colleague Dan McAdams wrote a nice book about Trump. It didn't end up explaining him. He could describe him.
When I was in graduate school, I thought the fundamental problem in the whole business is the problem of explanation. If you get clear in your mind about what counts as an explanation, then you're free to roam. And it's a problem that nobody takes very seriously. Mostly they think a prediction is explanation. It's not. Explanation is a lot of different things. But if you can categorize them in terms of some of these discrete categories and reliably categorize them and predict his behavior, then I think that's about as good as you can do. After that, you have to get into neurochemistry, biology, genetics.
I think this might sound quite disheartening to many aspiring researchers that explanation is beyond our scope and our ability.
It's beyond everybody's scope. It's the same in physics. They don't know what they're talking about. They just predict things.
I think I agree that I think we often have naive ideas about what we can do and what we can't do and what we should be doing and what we shouldn't be doing.
Don't forget, we can't predict that much. I mean, a lot of behavior is luck.
So my background is engineering and physics and then psychology. And one of the things I learned early on was I think the history of science is just backwards. I think science is based on engineers solving problems, putting practical solutions in place, and then physicists coming along and trying to explain it. I remember talking to the head of research for Netscape. It was at the time the largest, the best hard disk manufacturers in the world, and the head of research. And he said, we can put data points on a single molecule of, I don't know, and it works. I said, how does it work? He said, nobody knows. He said, we can do it. We can make these read-write mechanisms work. But he said, the physicists have no clue as to what we're doing. And there you have it. It's good enough to be able to do it. You want to explain it, that's another realm of discourse.
We used to think that, for instance, extroversion had a biological basis, which it does, and it was one thing, which it's not. And I had the idea, naive idea, that we have one or two genes. Well, no, that's nonsense. Turns out thousands and thousands of genes make you more likely to do any behavior. And so genetics has gone to that. Let's get the sum of all of these things to predict things. That's sort of the big, broad, big five things. That's like believing, my quote, of course, is taken from Hogan, as I said before we started, that to believe in latent variables is to believe in the Easter Bunny. And I love that quote, and I'm going to make it but it's a quote that I got from Bob, the personal communication Hogan, that latent variables don't exist. It's fun to think about them, but it's like believing Easter bunnies. They don't exist either.
At the heart of the enterprise is a fundamental confusion. Do you want to measure entities or do you want to predict outcomes? Those are two separate activities. You can measure entities all day long, but that is search for the Easter bunny, or you can try to predict outcomes, which is something that has a tangible result.
Yeah. Most of personality psychology for a long time has been about latent variables. So it must be quite disheartening for many people if you come along and say, you know, there are no latent variables. And then they will say, and I've heard this criticism said out loud, you know, if we let go of these latent variables, then what do we have left in personality psychology? Everything will just disintegrate.
Problems that are worth solving.
Choosing people to go off and fight, choosing people to go off and try to save the, I was in the Peace Corps, for instance, people who will go off and live in the jungles of Borneo. And what are the things that predict that? It's not a big five. It's, you know, it's what IPAR was doing in their personality assessments.
Well, what should people do who care about theory and models and aesthetical beauty that comes with all this? What should they do?
Take it seriously. Freud had a lot to say that's pretty important. Erickson had a lot to say that's pretty important. Karen Horney had a lot to say that's pretty important. That was the tragedy of Walter Mischel. He turned personality psychology into an anti-intellectual phenomenon. It's an anti-intellectual discipline today. If they're interested in interesting problems, they ought to get interested in interesting problems.
So we should take prediction more seriously and maybe defocus from this beautiful but not very useful models. I think people like Tali Arcuri have also made similar points recently. But now my question is, like, how can we achieve this? So if we really want to push the limits of prediction and predict as accurately as we can things like how well people manage at workplace or in their relationships or whether they're going to go and fight someplace or not, how can we improve the prediction, actually making a difference? And I feel that maybe we haven't made that much progress generally in the field that much over the last X years because we haven't really tried, just for the simple reason we really haven't tried. We've been happy with the models that we have, with the big few, with the latest latent theories, and that's been it. We've kind of thought that we've reached an asymptote in the progress of assessment, and so we haven't tried much harder. But if we want to now make progress and get better at predicting stuff, what could we really do?
I sort of disagree with you. One of your questions was, what's the most interesting new development? So back around 1990, I had a project with a big insurance company predicting performances insurance salesman. There was a guy named who had an awful inventory of personality disorders. And a colleague of mine, who's really good at item writing, put together an experimental battery of personality disorders. And my disloyal, my delinquent graduate student put that personality disorders measure into our selection battery. Against my, I would have never authorized it in the first place. Done. And it outpredicted the hell out of the HPI. And I thought, wow, there you go. Boom. So these personality disorders probably can see every, you guys, both of you have a substantial dark sides. And that'll explain a good bit of your performance. That, I think, is a very exciting move forward. You can't get to the dark side with five-factor model. Five-factor model is all about the bright side.
By dark side, do you mean the dark?
The DSM-3 axis to personality disorders, which are there. I mean, paranoia is quite real. You can't have a career in industry unless you're somewhat paranoid. People with high scores in paranoia know who their enemies are. They know who have to get them. They're politically quite astute. Richard Nixon was regarded as he was quite paranoid. He was regarded as the most astute politician in Washington. But there's a lot of juice there. It's a valid variance that you can't recover from the five-factor model. And it predicts the hell out of all kinds of aspects of real performance.
To follow up on that, the work that Hogan's group is responsible for is they are looking at real criteria. And most of the academic personality is not looking at criteria, very interesting criteria. But looking at who gets ahead is really important.
Yeah, or why they fail. My big one is leadership. And 100% of employed adults say they've spent some significant time working for an intolerable boss. 65 to 75% of the American workforce say the worst, the most stressful, the most toxic part of their lives is their immediate boss. You guys don't have bosses, so you don't have to deal with this. 75% of the U.S. workforce say they would take a pay cut if someone would fire their boss. 20% of the Baltimore workforce say they fantasize every day about killing their boss. Bad management, Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta say the principal cause of disease in American life is stress. The principal cause of stress in American life is bad management. So bad management is a public health hazard.
And that's why you say it has made sense to go beyond the socially desirable big five traits and measure the sort of darker traits that are the things that actually predict bad bosses.
Going back to the earlier part of our conversation, what's the problem today? No interest in ideas. Goffman talks about backstage and front stage behavior. Front stage behavior is the bright side. It's what you do when you're in front. Backstage behavior is what we do all the time when nobody's watching. That's what the dark side is. It's what you do when you think you can get away with it. It's not psychopathology. It's you, the real you. The real you that you react, you need to keep to yourself and probably ought to be ashamed of. The dark side is not psychopathology. It's reality. It's what people are really like when they stop pretending, when they stop putting on a proper front.
So one practical thing you suggest we could do in assessment is to have items in our assessment tools that also cover the negative side of personality.
And they're hard to write, by the way.
Going back to something we've been saying for quite a while, it's the item content that's important. And in terms of the prediction, I mean, you've shown, Renee, and I have shown, and Bob has shown, that at the predictions you can get from Big Five is less than if you look at what Bob calls Hicks, the homogeneous item composites, or Hogan item composites, depending how you want to look at it. The items themselves are better than that. Predictability gets better the more micro you get. And partly that's, can you choose the weird item?
I said the fundamental problem in the whole discipline is anti-intellectualism, a lack of interest in ideas, and a lack of careful conceptual analysis of what we're doing. And my favorite single example is the term self-report inventories or self-report. It's item responsive. Percy Bridgman, it's operational definitions. What are people doing? Well, a proper theory of item responses. It's not self-report. They're putting on a performance. Call these things self-reports is just utterly atheoretical. It's mindlessly stupid, actually. There's a whole agenda behind every item endorsement. The problem is to figure out what it is. Or actually, though, I'm not a big, it turns out as time goes by, I'm not so much of a fan of Paul Mill anymore. But one of the best things he ever said was, an item response is an inherently interesting piece of behavior, the meaning of which has to be determined empirically. And that goes back to Wittgenstein versus Plato. Items mean what they predict. I read 10 books every year. Who cares if they read 10? What they're trying to tell you is they're smart and they're open-minded. That's what they mean when they endorse an item like I read 10 books. And literal-minded academics say, well, you're getting books a year. Do you see my point?
Yes, so the scaled content should not be interpreted at face value and what we think, but based on what the
it
scale
predicts.
predict. Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
There are two items that I'd like that Bob has used. I asked him once to help select a CEO, and he gave this questionnaire to the current CEO. And one of the items he asked was, do you want to be a deep sea diver? And my friend who had been a deep sea diver said, no, I've done that. I don't want to do that anymore. This man was the current CEO. And the other question was, it was something like deep sea diving, or do you want to be a senior executive? No, I don't want to do that. And that's not any fun. That's why I'm looking for another CEO, because this man was a brilliant inventor, but he didn't want to be a CEO and he had done deep sea diving. How do you choose a CEO? You ask people, are you the sort of person who can be a CEO?
So I think we're getting some useful things actually said here. So if one thing we have to do is clearly we have to make the item content more diverse and more negative, not just the sort of usual positive, socially desirable stuff that we tend to have in the Big Five. And the other thing is that we have had this for a long time, this obsession with internal consistency in the scales, and the Cronbach-Huffer is a good example of this. It's impossible to submit a paper these days. Well, maybe it's gone better a little bit, but anyway, people will be asking you about what's the Cronbach-Huffer of the scale. And we know that Cronbach-Huffer in psychometrics, we know if you really think about this, that it's actually a pretty bad measure. It doesn't really track anything useful, and high level of Cronbach-Huffer internal consistency is actively a bad thing because it makes the scale more homogeneous and it makes its predictive power less than it would otherwise be. So that's one thing we could do. We could just somehow magically make the field forget about internal consistency and Cronbach-Huffer. But is there a way of doing this, actually?
Bill is 10 times the mathematician I am. I remember when I learned in graduate school about stepwise regression and the logic behind stepwise regression, I said, why wouldn't that apply to scale construction? That's my philosophy of scale construction.
That notion of regression says, get items that don't relate to each other.
Yes.
Because regression removes items that relate a lot. And people knew that in 1950, but they forgot about it. As it got so fun, it got so easy to put scales to items together. Back to the issue of item content, one of my favorite examples of the complexity of items is a very good measure of extroversion is I love life. It turns out it's also a very good measure of religious conservatism. It means something completely different to people who are in the pro-life movement.
But it's also probably pretty context specific because it doesn't mean anything like this where I'm currently. In Europe, it doesn't have that meaning, I suppose.
No, but in the United States, it turns out that item has a high correlation with extroversion, but also has a high correlation with religious conservatism at the same time. One of my students discovered this a couple of years ago, and it was, oh, of course, I never would have thought of that. But you have to understand the meaning of the item for the person.
Let's carry on with how we could make psychometrics more useful and better. And I think we can rely on Bob's ideas about one of the contributions you've made, Bob, is this differentiating between the reputation and identity. So the two sides of personality assessment, what people say about themselves, their identity, and what other people say about them, their reputation.
Goes right back to what I was saying about item endorsements. People endorse items based on they're sending identity signals. But what do they mean? They mean what they predict. What the meaning of those identity signals is the way they're translated into the person's actual reputation. And reputation predicts the hell out of everything. Reputations are quite stable over time. Identities flop around. Reputations are, you have to have a 100% change in behavior to get a 10% change in reputation. Reputations are the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. Reputation is summary of past behavior. It's the best data source we have regarding your future behavior. And you can't get the reputation from identity. You have to get the reputation from the peer group.
And you asked, why don't we use peer reports more? It's hard. It's the problem.
Yeah, it's hard data to get.
Much easier to ask you something about yourself than it is to ask us about you.
I think it used to be harder, right? But now we have internet, and the internet makes this data collection much easier because when somebody, you, for example, you invite a participant, and you can just tell the participants, if you don't mind, give an email of another person, the system sends email to another person, and if they're willing, they will complete the survey as well. So it's not maybe that hard anymore as it used to be.
But we've done that, and it turns out those ratings, they correlate highly with the criteria, with the self-report. They correlate with each other as much as they correlate with the self-report. I mean, so it's almost like the self-report's the true score, if you will. So you can build a path diagram of two peer ratings with self, and those paths of the peer with the self and the peer with the self, that correlation is the product of those two.
John Holland is my favorite guy that I met in my whole career. I really, really liked him. My favorite line from John Holland, he was the most published guy, one of the three most published scientists in America in the 20th century. One of my favorite lines was, he said, forget everything you learned in graduate school.
Yes.
Because it's all, if you were in graduate school, when we were in graduate school, you'd have learned about Walter Mischel. And that's just, it's, you have to be constantly. It was Theodore Milan was the name I was trying to, he's the guy who invented personality disorders. Remember him, Ted Milan? Edwin Hollander, who was a really smart guy, back in the mid early 1950s, did a study of performance in flight school and Navy flight school down in South Texas. And he showed that peer ratings, pilot potential, were the best single predictor of performance in flight school. It's just absolutely fascinating. The peers always know. They're the best predictors of leadership, the best predictors of everything. The peers know. I ran a program for gifted kids for a long time. I'm an anti-IQ guy as a result of that. There's a real difference between the kids the teachers thought were smart and the kids that the kids knew were smart. And I wanted to find some way of psychometrically disentangling that, because the second one, what the peers knew, was the real juice in IQ.
The big point here would be that even if it's difficult, we should really try to use more multiple raters if we want to predict outcomes better, which
Absolutely.
We should be doing.
So we validated our assessments against peer rating. So my line is the HPI is the second best way to do a 360.
Can you explain what do you mean by 360?
Well, 360 is your boss describes you, your peers describe you, and your subordinates describe you. That's the proper 360. But mostly it's just peers or subordinates. Bosses' ratings are terrible. They're terribly affected by HALO. But the HPI is the second best way to do a 360. The best way is to directly have people provide actual ratings.
I'm going to respond to the Holland quote about forget everything you learned at graduate school. And I will say something I learned before I went to graduate school is a PhD is a license to follow your nose. And so what we do with a PhD is we teach you how to solve problems. So that's what a PhD is for. And this is for other people who are watching this, that get a PhD, yes, but don't believe everything we teach you in graduate school, because we're teaching you the best we know right now. But for God's sakes, something is going to be better within 5 years.
And you need to adopt it when it comes along.
Right. And it took me 45 years to come to that understanding, but Hogan's been telling us for this for years, but it took me a long time to believe some of these things.
That's very nice. Bob, could you tell us what would it take if somebody wanted to build a successful business in psychological assessment?
Well, you have to start with the customer. You have to find a customer who's got a problem and ask them what the problem is that they want you to solve, and you work from there. Don't sit in your office and invent something and think that the people will buy it. You have to go to them and find out what their problems are and then construct an assessment to fix that. And it turns out that their problems are always the same. Between the Navy and graduate school, I worked as a probation officer for a while in Euro stomping grounds, East Los Angeles, San Bernardino County. Initially, it was quite fascinating, but after about 6 or 7 months, they all just get in trouble for the same reasons. Everyone, it's just another case like this, another case like this. It's the same in organizations. Every organization thinks their problems are perfectly unique, but they're not. They're all the same. But you go and ask them, and you pretend like you care, and you say, what's the problem? Or hopefully they'll come. You must happen to you all the time, Bill. People call up the psychology department and say, I got this problem. Can you help me fix it? It happened to me all the time at Johns Hopkins. Just start with the customer. Start with the client. Start with the people out there who have a problem.
Right. So don't develop a beautiful psychometric tool that has a beautiful factor structure and high internal consistency and whatever the desirable things might be, but do something that does what the client needs.
Yes.
Done.
And it'll turn out that by the time you have five clients, you'll see the generality or the similarity of all their problems.
That sounds easy enough. So I suspect, Bob, you will have a lot of competitors in your field soon.
We have a lot of competitors.
Yeah.
Let me put in a plug for us. We are the only commercial test publisher on earth that takes validity seriously. We can justify every single empirical claim that we make, and none of our competitors play the game right. None of them even bother with validity. They think their line is the clients think the validity is already in place, and it's not. Our competitors are selling cars with no engines. They compete with us on the, what they call customer experience, not on the basis of what. You can't sell validity to HR weenies. They want the customer experience. It's a struggle. It's actually hard. Swimming in a tank full of sharks. It's like, actually, it's like being in academia, swimming in a tank full of people who steal your ideas and publish. The first set of paper I wrote in graduate school showed up in Psych Bulletin 9 months later without my name on it.
So business sounds much easier.
Just like academia.
It's been very nice to have that discussion. And I think I've learned a lot. And I think our listeners will learn a lot from your open-mindedness. And for example, Bill's ability to, after 45 years, change your mind about what you've done for a long time. And also your ability to see psychology as a practical science. And thanks for this discussion, Bill and Bob.
Thank you for inviting me.